Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my honored guest is Laurie Moore. Her book of short stories, Bark from Knopf, is the occasion. And I'm fascinated by this book for many reasons. First of which is that these stories seem to be written the way poetry gets written. You know, some poets at the bottom of a poem will say, after Mandelstam, or after Robert Frost. The poem has been inspired by another poet. In this book, Bark, there's one that says, after Vienne, and I know that that's Vladimir Nabokov, and there's another called Wings, which is after H.J., Henry James, Wings of the Dove. That seems like a brand new thing.
Well, I think those are the only two stories that bounce off of other literary sources. The Nabokov, it was some kind of referential echo that was born in my brain after reading Signs and Symbols, a story by Nabokov, about 2 years ago. And I sat down and I literally followed the story pretty much. And I thought, what if you did a parallel narrative? Now, I didn't know whether this was permissible or not. And maybe it's still not. But I did it because, as with all great literature, when you go back to it, you discover different things. The emphases in your reading are different. And I suddenly became very interested in that son. I became interested in the nature of the relationship in the Nabokov. What would happen if these characters actually weren't like that, didn't have that solid marriage? And what if they weren't immigrants and you took that aspect out, but could you still have a story? And the Nabokov story is a perfect story, and I have this kind of thing that's hanging and chattering in the shadows of it, but it follows it very closely. The Wings is just a plot element I lifted. It doesn't follow the James very closely.
I think, in fact, that this impermissible thing, so-called, is in fact happening, and it's the reason I bring it up. Zadie Smith wrote a novel in answer to Foster's Howard's End.
Howard's End, right.
Not just that, to my great surprise and pleasure, Ian Lee confided when I said, hey, all through your new book, Kinder Than Solitude, I'm hearing Elizabeth Bowen's The Death of the Heart. And she said, well, that's because it's an answer book to Death of the Heart. I read it around six times while I was writing it, and no one has seen it. Thank you, Michael. It could have gone on forever without anyone noticing. And I think it's, personally, I think it's now that we can no longer count on people to have read Howard's End or Death of the Heart. A writer who does read, writers do read. It's not a lie. People keep saying, oh, that no one's reading. Writers are reading. Writers are reading the great books, and they are doing these responses almost as if it were a kind of, what would you say, civic duty? If you're not going to respond, we're going to respond. If there are no more good literary critics, we're going to write our criticism in the form of another work of art.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, and that of course is really what it feels like. It feels like you're having a conversation with the story. Like, there is this great story, now I'm going to have this conversation with it.
In both of these stories, the one called Referential by Laurie Moore, the one called Signs and Symbols by Nabokov, there's a couple who have an emotionally disturbed child in an institution. Except the married couple in the Nabokov story, they love and protect one another, and they come home, and they are, as immigrants, each other's solace. Their child is something, if anything, that has helped the marriage grow more deeply bonded.
Right.
Whereas in Bark, as in the rest of the stories, referential is about two people who might have been married, except the disturbed son is a bar, an obstacle to that. The man is afraid of it. The woman would like to have someone at her side. Please, let's bring him home. You stay part of the night with him, and I'll stay part of the night with him. And in this book of stories, strangely, in story after story, it seems that parents spend more time in bed with their children than they do with their spouses or lovers. This is a very strange impulse. Can you tell me about
it? Welcome to America. Well, I was with that story, with referential, I think I was interested in the complete aloneness, really, of everyone, of all the characters. And in the Nabokov, they don't actually visit the son.
But yes, they come home.
And so the son really has no speech. He's not given a presence. But I thought, since it is a triangle, there's three people here, I'm going to give them all things to say and all of them ways to sort of dramatize and express their utter isolation.
Yes, I thought that the way the stories work in general is that there is a triangle, man, woman, disturbed and or sick other, child or older man in wings, and that each story examines this triangle from one of its vertices, from one of its angles.
Well, that's interesting. I think that could very well be true. And certainly, you know, with James's stories, there was always a triangle in his novels, and he just sort of spun that triangle around and looked at it differently and asked different questions and got different answers at the end. A triangle will exist maybe anywhere in any story, and it depends how much you want to emphasize it.
Yes, but my guest, Laurie Moore, the author of Bark, published by Knopf, a volume of 8 stories, I get the feeling that this is the saddest, the most alone of the books, and consequently the one in which wisecracks are the most constant. The wisecracks point to a terrible insolubility in the situations. It's as if we can't escape, let's at least joke. But there's a suspicion somewhere that if you were to examine this triangle, maybe this time around, the fourth time, the fifth time, the sixth time, the seventh time, there'd be an escape route. That somehow the aloneness and sadness has grown too great to handle, too great to be endurable. Everything is a trap. The trap building is in the shape of a triangle, and the escape from the trap is the writing of a short story. Maybe this time round, the story will give me a way out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. At the end of Subject to Search, there actually is an image of clowns who have escaped the circus. And they've come into to yes. a church and to sit in the back of the pews. And that is a kind, and she says to the man that she really loves, actually, it's kind of a love story, although he is of ambiguous character, but not unsympathetic. But she says, so they've come in from the cold. And she said, yeah, they've come in to be together, you know.
What's happening is a man is on his way home. The information about Abu Ghraib has broken. He is a consultant, a kind of, what do you call them, ghost?
Well, I think he was once part of military intelligence, and now he's like an outsourced intelligence analyst. There are a lot of those people that are used.
And
working from home.
And he represents, in a way, a break from the triangle. And so, although he's miserable at what he has to spin when he gets home to America, this whole terrible fact of what the troops have done in the prison to the prisoners, what he had warned them about not doing, which they read as do sexually humiliate your captive, do pose them naked, when he'd said don't. Again, another bleakness, because it feels almost parental. Again here, you know, someone issuing instructions which teenagers can never, never, never follow.
Well, and he does say these soldiers are just kids. They're just kids. But yeah, that story is set in Paris in April. April in Paris,
April
what could be better?
Paris.
Unfortunately, it's 2004, April in Paris. And so this was the story, big international story that broke and that they both then have to confront.
Do you have a section of that story that you can read from?
I can read what, I could read the beginning, I could read the end.
Yeah, the end is great.
You want the, will it spoil it to read the end? Maybe not.
A short story is 16 pages long. How much spoiling can be done?
I don't know. I have a highly inflamed sense of spoiling. Years earlier, at a Christmas party of a mutual friend, their spouses both out on the wintry summer porch smoking, she had found herself next to him in the kitchen, jiggling the open bottles of wine to see which one might not be empty. The day before, along with a photo of prize-winning gingerbread houses on display at the mall, he had sent her an email. "I just took 3 Adderall and made these for you." In the next room, Bob Dylan was singing, "Gotta Serve Somebody." "What is the thing you regret most in life?" he asked her, standing close. There were perhaps a dozen empty bottles, and she and Tom methodically tipped every one of them upside down, held them up to the light, sometimes peering into them from underneath. "Nothing but dead soldiers here," he murmured. "I'd like to say optimistically that they were half full, not half empty, but these are just totally empty." "Unless you have a life of great importance," she said. "Regrets are stupid, crumpled up tickets to a circus that has already left town." His face went bright with amusement and drink. "Then what happens to the town?" he asked. She thought about this. "Oh, there's a lot of weather," she said slowly. "It snows, it thunders, the sun comes out. People go to church and sit in the sanctuary, and sometimes they see escaped clowns sitting in the back pews with their white gloves still on." "Escaped clowns?" he asked. "Escape," she said. "Sort of escaped." "Come in from the cold?" he inquired. "Come in to sit next to each other," she said. He nodded with satisfaction. "The past is for losers, baby?" "Kind of like that," she said. She wasn't sure that she agreed, but she understood the power of such a thought. His stance grew jaunty. He leaned in close to her, up against the kitchen counter's edge. Do you ever feel that no one knows what you're talking about, that everyone is just pretending except for me? She studied him carefully. Yes, I do, she said. I do. Ah, he replied, straightening his posture. He clasped her hand. Electricity burst into it, then vanished as he let go. We're all suckers for a happy ending.
Maury Moore, reading The End of Subject to Search, a short story from her collection, Bark.
It ends like a wedding, where she says, I do. So if you end with a wedding, it's a happy ending. And so he says, we're all suckers for a happy ending.
I knew the woman, her name was Carol Eastman, who under the name Adrian Joyce had written the screenplay to Five Easy Pieces. Wonderful American screenplay. And she told me that Marlon Brando had called her up on the phone. And he said, because he wanted her to write something for him, mm-hmm. He said, Carol, when is the last time that someone said, I love you, and you could hear it and feel it was being meant? And of course, for a woman of that generation, the star of Streetcar Named Desire, Marlon Brando, was saying this to her, the last time that someone looked into your eyes and said, I love you. And this is what happens here. Do you ever feel that no one knows what you're talking about, that everyone is just pretending except for me?
Except for me.
What?
And she says, I do. I do. That's what she feels at that moment.
Although there are not moments of satisfaction in these stories, there are moments of satisfactorily expressed yearning, which seems to almost do as well. What do you think?
Well, if all love dies, then, you know, you only have, you know, you just have your yearning and your aching and your, you know, and the love while it lives. And maybe we're greedy to want more, but you know, to appreciate the small portions we get, it's very key.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and I'm talking with Maury Moore about her book, Bark. Even though this is a very emotional moment, we'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Maury Moore about her latest book of stories, Bark, a sometimes biting collection of short stories about everything from divorce to singing with ghosts. Now, that question about bark being worse than bite, which is worse?
Well, I think a bite is always worse. It's always worse. But bark means many things. It's an animal cry, and so we have to sort of, you know, align ourselves with that idea of expression, that expression is good, that to cry out is to both sing and to call and to greet. The other meaning of bark, of course, is that it's the bark of a tree, it's the bark of a vessel that you can, you know, float in, like a barge, like a boat, like the bark of Dante. To bark a shin is to injure it. So it's a good Anglo-Saxon word that's got a lot of different contexts.
Well, just as there are stories that seem to be after certain writers, there are three epigraphs, each of them from women poets. I wondered if you'd read them, because each of them has to do with the different meaning of bark. Let's hear them.
The first one is from Carol Squires, "An Apple Tree Spouts Philosophy in an Office Car Park." I shall still be here, growing my bark around the wire fence like a grin. The next one is Louise Glick, "Vita Nova." In the splitting up dream, we were fighting over who would keep the dog, Blizzard. You tell me what that name means. He was a cross between something big and fluffy and a dachshund. Does this have to be the male and female genitalia? Supposing I'm the dog, as in my child self, unconsolable because completely pre-verbal. Oh, Blizzard, be a brave dog. This is all material. You'll wake up in a different world. You will eat again. You will grow up into a poet. Life is very weird, no matter how it ends, very filled with dreams. And the last is from Amy Gersler's "Interview with a Dog." Don't be gruff. Anything that falls on the floor is mine.
I love that. I especially love that because, you know, Amy is a poet who lives in Los Angeles.
That's what I'm told. I didn't know much about her, but I've been learning.
She's a fantastic poet.
I know she is. She's really great. And I just love, I love the way, the artistic claim that is made in that line. You know, anything that falls on the floor is mine.
Because I felt that the influence of poetry and its designs were very strong in this book, more so than in the others, that insinuation, a procedure by insinuation, a multiplicity of resonances all working at the same time, that while you weren't going to spoil anyone's good time by denying them yucks.
Well, right. I can only tell a story so far before humor comes knocking at the door and demands to come in. So you can lock it out, or you can just let it walk in.
But this time, I think that you're experimenting with bringing the stories closer to poetry in their rhythms, in the way they really make the feelings full and devastating. The other stories maybe took a couple of steps back before full devastation arrived. But here, I guarantee the reader, if you've been feeling like you've been having trouble feeling, and many people do nowadays, feeling fully, and I know people who stay away from certain movies because they don't want to feel fully, but this is a book. You're not seeing things you don't want to see. This is, you know, the restoration of human feelings, of loss, of gratitude, even relief that something that would have turned out horrible didn't happen.
Right.
You didn't have to live through that.
I think stories begin with feelings. I think then you have to kind of forge around for the language. They begin with feelings, they begin with people, and that ideas are the last things to come in, but the feelings are the first.
No one's going to have a context for this, but just listen to the cadence of this sentence. I needed my breath for dancing, so I tried not to laugh. Instead, I fixed my face into a grin, and for a second, the sun came out to light up the side of the red and spinning barn. You worked that sentence, didn't you?
I did, I have to admit. But I mean, I took commas in and out, I took words in and out, and I, you know, can it be a spinning red barn, or does it have to be the red and spinning barn? You have to write to your ear. And since it was the last sentence, not only of that story, but of the entire book, I really had to make sure the rhythm was right and that the reader could hear the rhythm. And also that sentence is also a little bit my farewell to Wisconsin, which, you know, I haven't entirely left, but I have taken a job in Nashville, so I live in Tennessee now.
Okay, 30 years was it in Wisconsin?
30 years.
And why Tennessee?
Well, Vanderbilt University asked me if I'd like a job there. And they offered me a very nice one. And so I said, okay. And now I'm there.
And tell me, because this is the final question, is there a way in which writing a story can be a cure or a help toward a cure for misery? Or is misery just a given?
Oh, I think misery is a given, but if you're a writer, you're always less miserable when you're writing. Not that it's cathartic, but you just feel you're doing your work and it's work you love. So it's not about catharsis. It's about just creating something that hasn't existed in the world before. Creating something new and knowing that that's what you're supposed to be doing.
What you were put here for.
Well, you may have been put here for other things too, but you know, at some point you realize this is what you've chosen, this is what you're doing, this is who you are. I mean, it takes a couple of decades for that to sort of sink in, I think, but so to that extent, writing will always make a writer less miserable.
I've been talking with Laurie Moore, author of Bark, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me. I've often been impressed by Laurie Moore's stories, but completely cowed when talking to her. Thank you for your emotional availability today. I really appreciated talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Bark at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.